From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. The Beatles are back. All of their albums have been re-released in new remastered versions. The music sounds better than ever, and it sounded pretty good the first time we heard it on our old 45s and LPs. Also, the Beatles' music is featured in a new version of the video game Rock Band, bringing their music in a new way to a whole new generation. All of this is an excuse for us to invite Philip Norman back to the show. Biographer, novelist, and playwright Philip Norman is the author of Shout, The Beatles in Their Generation, the Desert Island volume of books about the Beatles, and most recently, John Lennon, The Life, an in-depth biography of the complex personality at the center of the Beatles. Philip Norman, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much.
The Beatles met record producer George Martin in 1962. Tell us a little bit about their working relationship with Martin.
George Martin was very unusual. Of course, in those days, record producers were not in any way celebrities. They were really sort of technicians, but they also had complete power over the artists who did the recording. George Martin very soon saw that he had to give more and more power over their music to the Beatles, to John Lennon and Paul McCartney in particular. So he became, from being a sort of all-powerful figure, someone who was much more like an editor who would sort of, you know, make the work, bring the work to its sort of full power. He was a remarkably unselfish and honest person. He never tried to... He could have got his name on Lennon McCartney song very easily. Lots of producers did that, but he simply didn't. He confined himself to making the music sound as good as it possibly could.
Well, sort of, the, you know, it reminds me of Norman Petty and Buddy Holly. I guess that's what Norman Petty did, right, to Buddy Holly?
Well, Norman Petty, yes, would stick his name on, songs written by Buddy Holly and the other Crickets. But it was a sort of standard practice in the business. Or Martin could have written his own songs and insisted they were the B-sides to Lennon McCartney A-sides, but he did none of that. And, of course, really did not get terribly rich, but... You know, it was the satisfaction of making this music happen to the utmost that was enough for him.
It was pretty fortunate that the Beatles ended up with George Martin then.
Well, they were fortunate in having George Martin as record producer, fortunate in having Brian Epstein as a manager, who maybe didn't do the greatest deals that he could have done, but again was always thinking of their best interests and was not, you know, exploiting them. He was taking it decent percentage, but he treated them almost like his children. He was a gay man at a time in Britain when that was illegal, and they were his sort of surrogate children. Dick James, the record, the song publisher who started Northern Songs, although an astute businessman, again was not a ruthless, exploitative type. So could easily have been. So there were three honest men really sort of directing the Beatles' career, and that was amazing.
Not to say that lots of people didn't get rich somehow taking advantage, but it's good that those particular people were honest and great. Now, Brian Epstein did not, after their, once they got signed to EMI, he really didn't take an active role in what they recorded so much, right?
That became less. In a way, they were sort of rejecting Brian Epstein's influence from the moment he sort of cleaned them up and made them sort of show busy, because there was no rock culture in those days. Pop bands had to join conventional showbiz, and that was the way that Brian got them into the spotlight. But as they developed creatively, then they had really less sort of reliance on Brian's opinion. What they did rely on Brian Epstein for was this sort of protective shield. They didn't really have to worry about the outside world. He took all the sort of pressure away from them. They could concentrate on, obviously, a tremendously heavy touring schedule and recording.
Now, when George Martin first met the Beatles, he assumed that he was going to turn them into... one of them was going to be the front man, and the rest would be a backing band, and he sort of changed his mind?
Yes, that was the style in Britain. I mean, British pop was not... terribly high quality in those days, and the only sort of guitar group singer that had really done brilliantly well was Cliff Richard and the Shadows, and that was Cliff, and The Shadows. And so, Martin was looking to see who would be his Cliff Richard. He did think of John as being a kind of Cliff Richard. It was ridiculous. But he, to his credit, eternally, he realized that they had much more strength when they were sharing the limelight and they were doing their wonderful harmonies.
And he also had the foresight to see that their original songs were worth pursuing.
Yes, that took a while, because the first ones that they played to him, he wasn't terribly impressed by. And the first release, Love Me Do, no one would say that was their best song. They'd written better songs by that point. Please Please Me underwent this kind of editing process with Martin, but then, of course, it became a big hit in the UK. But still, they were doing lots of cover versions. I mean, they were amazing mimics, apart from everything else. They could do marvelous cover versions of quite intricate and difficult American songs.
Oh, and, we get to hear some of those on their records and lots of them on the BBC recordings that have been released. What about the songwriting styles of Lennon and McCartney? In John Lennon: A Life, you sort of detailed the differences between their writing styles. Can you comment on that a little?
Well, the extraordinary thing, firstly, it's very unusual for a songwriting partnership to have both partners writing the words and the music. Each sort of writing the lyrics, then having the idea for the melody, and right at the beginning, as we know, they would write sort of first of all in Paul McCartney's living room at his house. Later on, when they were on tour, they'd sit in a hotel bedroom and write a song together. As they got richer and more famous and began to lead slightly more separate existences, they would write on their own. But they would always, each would always go to the other for sort of advice or help or an opinion. That they did really stay reliant on one another, because each of them, although they were very different, could assume very easily the personality of the other one. John, we think of as hard-edged rock and roll. Yet John really loved ballads and was pretty sentimental at heart. He could write a Paul McCartney-sounding song. McCartney, though, of course, did write beautiful ballads, but he could also write a pretty hard-edged rock song. And each of them would go to the other for part of, an idea, a bit of the song, finishing off the lyric, anything like that. The famous example is A Day in the Life, which is, I suppose, many people would think was John Lennon's masterpiece. And yet the middle section is a sort of fragment that McCartney had sort of got in his bottom drawer. And the song would not, or the record would really not be the same without that little bit of McCartney in the middle.
Well, it's interesting that you make the distinction between song and record. I mean, there is a certain point in their evolution in which they're no longer making songs, but much more making records. I mean, if you're young, if you haven't been there like we were as the records were released and you hear, She Loves You next to A Day in the Life, it seems like a pretty sharp contrast. But at the time, when Sgt. Pepper came out, while it, was a revelation and a masterpiece and all that, it didn't seem like a gigantic departure from their previous work. How did their music kind of evolve from that four-man band to the instrumentation and presentation of their later work?
If you look back, they made enormous strides. I mean, from Love Me Do to Sgt. Pepper in a very few years. And because they were always trying to go one better, trying to outdo themselves, and they felt very keenly threatened by other bands, first of all by other British bands, then when they made it in America, very, very much in competition with bands like the Beach Boys, and then so the Beach Boys felt the same. They were all really competing with one another, and this produced fantastic work. They were very friendly, the bands, to one another, very little sort of hostility or jealousy. But they were always trying to compete with another top-class act. And they were always thinking of being original. They were not just thinking of, something that would sell.
Well, so sort of take us through those years between, Love Me Do and Sgt. Pepper. What happened in the studio that, what went on there that allowed for this kind of this arc of creativity?
Well, the main thing was totally changing the relationship between the performers or the recording artists and the studio management. In the end, Martin simply let them use the Abbey Road EMI studios as a rehearsal room where the music evolved. When they started, and when they recorded Love Me Do, studios were very formal places where the technicians wore white coats, just to emphasize this was a kind of laboratory which the lay person couldn't possibly understand. In the end, the Beatles themselves were using the recording studio rather like a sort of, you know, they were like sort of children in a toy shop. They were picking up instruments and saying they'd like to try this or that. And Martin would enable these things to happen. So that was the difference in the relationship between the producer and the musician. And the other thing that happened was that what they did in the studio in the end became more and more difficult to reproduce on stage in live performance. So in the end, they decided that they'd become disillusioned with live performance because people screamed so much in the audience that they couldn't hear the music, the Beatles couldn't hear themselves. So what they were really doing in the end was giving performances in the recording studio via the albums.
Well, you'd think that they would love the fact that their fans love them so much. I mean, they had, when they first began, they certainly had the ambition of, you know, putting on a killer show that everybody loved, and here you have thousands of people coming to see them and screaming the whole time, but that was something they came to hate.
It was, because it was just mindless. I mean, it had nothing to do with anything. You know, they could have, John used to crash his arm over the keys of his electric organ because he knew no one would notice. It was just sheer frustration. And it was awful in the end. I mean, it was like a sort of, you know, a dreadful kind of sonic torment. And also the feeling that it being a success and being praised and being loved like that in the beginning, of course it's, you know, euphoric experience, but it very quickly turned into something quite horrible. And particularly the sort of the pressure of being on tour and really not, you know, never seeing the daylight, you know, being little sort of hamsters in treadmills.
And we're talking with Philip Norman, who is a playwright, biographer, author. His biographies include books about Buddy Holly and the Rolling Stones and Elton John and, of course, the Beatles and John Lennon. It is interesting that this whole story that you've spent so much time telling us happens in this short period of you know, basically 8 years. Nowadays, you know, if an artist puts out two albums in 8 years, that's a big deal. How could they possibly have done so much work in such a short time?
They were, of course, John Lennon and Paul McCartney were amazingly prolific in the work that they put out. They managed to be a live performing band whose tours and whose appearances were just headline news. And kind of rushing into the studio whenever they had time to make an album. Very, very heavy recording schedule put on them, because the assumption in those days was that this is going to be all over very quickly and you have to get as much out of it as you can. Nobody thought that any of these bands, I mean, you know, the Beatles or the Stones or any of them, were going to last 5 years. I mean, let alone, you know, 40
almost,
years.
Almost 50.
50 years.
Yeah.
it was all rock and roll, and rock music was considered a kind of confidence trick. That just sort of the kids were being duped, and then they would wake up to the confidence trick and move on to something else. Nobody had any idea that it would just turn into this amazing sort of juggernaut, which is still rolling on, of course.
It does seem odd that it's been almost 50 years since their first recording session. I mean, not that far from 50 years. And certainly 50 years ago, they were playing together and had begun their travels toward worldwide fame. When did you first become aware of the Beatles?
I became aware of them as a local journalist in part of England called East Anglia, which is very boring and very flat. And I just became aware of them in sort of terms of controversy because of their hair. And these sort of records were considered very, very loud, and then the screaming that was going on. I wasn't in a position on that very small newspaper to write about them, or not very much. But then when I got onto quite a much bigger paper in the Northeast, in Newcastle-on-Tyne, a big industrial city, they came on tour, their last UK tour. Nobody knew it was their last UK tour, but it turned out to be. I did get into their dressing room backstage and talk to John and Paul and Ringo for quite a long time. In fact, I was thrown out of the dressing room by Neil Aspinall, the roadie, because I was outstaying my welcome.
Did you record that conversation, or just
I didn't
take
record
notes?
It. No, mm-hmm. I just sort of remembered it in my head and wrote it. Then later on, it always seemed to me that everybody else in the world, every other writer under the sun, was writing about the Beatles, and no room for me, as I thought. And particularly in London, there were certain journalists who were always writing about them and seemed to have total access to them. But then in 1969, I was assigned by an American magazine, Show Magazine, to find out what was happening at the Apple Company, which was obviously in trouble. Nobody really knew what was going on. And I was given the most amazing access by Derek Taylor, their press officer, to sort of hang around the place, and I was hanging around the place for weeks on end. And that was when they were breaking up, really. John and Yoko were on the ground floor doing their peace campaign. McCartney wasn't there at all. George was in and out, and Ringo would come in sometimes. He'd have a boiled egg, you know. If he was in the West End, he'd come in for a sort of light meal, something like that, or get them to buy him a new pair of boots or a wristwatch. And so I was as a witness to this sort of great final act.
Did you get to know them, or you were just observing them?
No, I didn't get to know them. I mean, John Lennon got to know me by sight, and I saw Yoko, the early version of Yoko, who was at the time being absolutely reviled in the media and was being accused of breaking up the Beatles, which of course was untrue, was accused of being mad because she was a conceptual artist. Nobody knew what conceptual art was in those days in the UK, or very few people. So that was my... that was the extent of my sort of contact with them until really John's death. I'd finished my book Shout, but I'd left a bit open at the end because I was hoping to speak to John, who recently reemerged from retirement. But then the news came that he had been killed, and so I couldn't, the book had to go to press as it was. But then when that came out in the US, Yoko invited me to the Dakota. That was only 5 months after John's death, so she showed me around in the room where he had spent most of those 5 years playing his guitar and looking at the trees in Central Park. So I was just too late.
Now, Yoko did help you or provided interviews for your biography of John Lennon Alive, but then she was kind of unhappy with the final product. What happened there?
Well, I still don't know, because Yoko was fantastically honest, told me really everything about their relationship in a way that I believed. I felt that Yoko herself had been done a grave injustice, that she really had been the person that John needed to be with, the person who really stimulated him in every way, I mean, all the facets of his talent, not just music. And for a long, long time, relationship with Yoko was extremely cordial, and she only made one condition, really, but that was reading the manuscript for factual accuracy. So I did send the unedited manuscript for her to read, and then she said that I'd been unfair to John in it, and mean to John, as she put it, and I was really dumbfounded, because I felt that I'd written about John in the way that Yoko always talked to me about him. I'd done long interviews with her before. She always said that I was someone who really understood John, and that I gave a sort of balanced view of John, not just a hagiographical view of John. But she decided that it was that I hadn't sort of conveyed the full sort of extent of his genius. Although she said I'd been very nice about her, which I always intended to be.
So I assume you haven't had a chance to discuss it with her since the book was published.
Not since then. Nobody really. All the sort of reviews all over the world that have been written of this book, no one has said that I was anti-John. What would be the sense of writing a biography of this length about someone that you didn't like?
Well, of course, has happened, yeah. And it did happen to John Lennon, right? Because there was that stupid The Lives of John Lennon by... what's his name?
Albert Goldman, yes.
Yes.
Well, that was a sort of freak, not in the mainstream of biography at all, sort of written from the sort of vengefulness of one sort of, academic who thought he knew best about everything, but didn't really know much about anything.
That's a terrible book. But your book, everybody, by the way, listening, everybody should read it. It's a marvelous book, John Lennon, alive. And we're speaking with the author, Philip Norman. So there came a certain point in the Beatles' recording career where they stopped performing covers. What happened to the covers in their set? They focused more on their own songs because they wanted
to,
or had to?
The other thing to remember is that in those days, performances did not last like they do today for two and a half hours. Leonard Cohen will do 3 hours. They were only on stage for about 25 minutes, and that was just to do the, you know, hits and a few things from the recent album, and then it was all over. They were very, very brief, the stage appearances, and yes, they would do... They pretty soon stopped doing cover versions because they had so much of their own material to do.
But when they're facing a deadline of, you know, they've got to get this album out by Christmas, how come they didn't just pull out one of their covers or something? They didn't want to anymore.
They were doing that really sort of until the Beatles For Sale album, but after that they just had so much to. They never gave short measure. They always gave good value. I mean. You know, the Abbey Road album, even when they sort of served up a lot of little sort of fragments joined together of unfinished songs, it turned out to be wonderful.
Yeah, no kidding. And it does sound great on the new remixes remastered. And the albums have been released in both mono and stereo versions, and I wonder if you would weigh in on that. What is your opinion on, should we get the mono or the stereo?
Well, it's all a matter of opinion. I mean, I think that just to have this sort of very enhanced version of songs, which are really sort of second nature to so many people, is tremendously interesting. You have a much more feeling of being there, of picking up the small detail of songs that were originally recorded on very, very primitive equipment, relatively speaking. It's never mattered, but now one can realize that it's as if the windows have all been cleaned and they're all bright and clear and you can see through them much better.
Have you heard some things in them that you, even all the time you spent listening to them, had never heard before? Or
it's just a general kind of freshness and intimacy. You know, there's so much more now.
You mentioned their rivalry with Dylan and the Byrds and the Beach Boys. How much did those three influence what they did?
It was like a sort of ping-pong game, really, across the Atlantic. The Beatles, initially, of course, influenced by American music enormously, going over and playing American music to the Americans with a British accent, and then the Americans responding by starting to play like the Beatles, the British version of rock and roll played by Americans. And it was amazing kind of cultural sort of cross-match. In the end, even some American bands were trying to put on Liverpudlian accents. But certainly that John was tremendously sort of focused on what Bob Dylan was doing. Dylan, who has always had this surprising sort of interest in popular, you know, top 20 music, very, very keenly aware of what they were doing as well.
You know, for us Americans out here in America, you know, all of the British accents just sound like British accents, but the Beatles accents... there was some sort of class consciousness about the way they spoke, and that was a big deal, that they maintained their accents the way they were without polishing them up?
Yes. The thing was that there were lots of entertainers had come from Liverpool before this, a lot of comedians and singers too. They'd always been told, when they get to London, lose the Liverpudlian accent. People just would be put off by it in the South. The Beatles didn't. Of course, the Beatles made Liverpudlian very, very fashionable. Lots of people who weren't from Liverpool started to pretend they were. Even the Prime Minister, who just happened to represent a constituency in the area of Liverpool, suddenly started emphasizing he was, you know, a Liverpudlian by adoption. And the joke was that John Lennon had been brought up in a very middle-class home where the Liverpudlian accent was not approved of at all. His Aunt Mimi, who lived with him, did not like to hear him talking in a Liverpudlian accent. And when he became famous with the Beatles and Liverpool was sort of, everybody wanted this kind of Liverpudlian talk, John had to really sort of put it on. And his Aunt Mimi said, well, why are you talking in that funny voice, John? You don't talk in that voice. And it was just a pragmatic decision of John's.
Did you get a chance to meet Aunt Mimi and interview her for your work?
I did. When I was doing the previous book, Shout, I phoned her up and she allowed me to go down and see her. And she was living near Bournemouth on the south coast of England. And she was amazingly like John. She looked like John. And she had the same kind of scatty sort of humor and very, very, very good sense of humor. And I spent quite a few hours talking to her.
Now, I'm going to guess from what I've read of yours that you would pick as your favorite Beatle album or the best Beatle album, Revolver, even though you just said A Day in the Life is John's masterpiece. Am I right or wrong?
I think you're right. Revolver is a marvelous album, and so is Rubber Soul. I mean, this is the sort of this is when they are so very tight, you know, as a band. Lennon and McCartney are just writing superbly. And there isn't any kind, you know, they're still happy to be together as the Beatles. That, you know, the sheer sort of euphoria that comes through and the creative euphoria is still wonderful.
It's kind of like a time machine listening to it again, isn't it?
Oh, sure. And John in particular, I mean, it's just sort of very often he personally is, he always was feeling insecure. He never really felt happy with himself or with his music. But that kind of insecurity is coming out in you know, marvelous sort of ways of expression.
Well, the most recent book from Philip Norman is John Lennon, The Life. What are you working on now?
I'm doing The Life of Mick Jagger.
Oh, well, that will be fun. Will you come back and talk to us about that when it's ready?
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not for better. Some have gone and some remain. All these places had their moments with lovers and friends. I still can recall. Some are dead and some are living. In my life, I've loved them all. But of all these friends and lovers, there is no one compares with you. And these memories lose their meaning when I think of love as something new. Though I know I'll never lose affection for people and things that went before, I know I'll often stop and think about them. In my life I love you more. For people and things that went before, I know I'll often stop and think about them. In my life, I love you more. In my life, I love you more.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. Thanks to Philip Norman for being our guest, and thanks, as always, to our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.